You're listening to NPR on Health. I'm your host, Joe Neal. In today's podcast, we'll hear about those salmonella-contaminated tomatoes and some ideas about how they may have gotten that way. Then we'll have a story about a phenomenon called underinsurance. That's where people who have health insurance may not have enough to cover all the care that they need. After that, NPR's Joanne Silberner takes a look at efforts to computerize medical records. And finally, NPR's Joe Shapiro visits a school in Ohio where they try to use volunteer work to help keep aging brains healthy. We assigned NPR's Allison Aubrey to the tomato beat this week. As I record this, there have been about 200 people who've gotten sick from the salmonella-contaminated tomatoes. These are raw Roma, plum, and red round tomatoes. And in the course of following this latest food scare, Allison learned some interesting facts about how the tomatoes might have gotten contaminated. Here's her report.
If you're thinking that almost all tomatoes are red and round, you may be wondering if there's a safe bet at the moment. So far, what investigators know is that cherry, grape, and tomatoes sold with the vines still attached have not been implicated by people who've gotten sick. And to the question, can tomatoes simply be cleaned off to get rid of the salmonella bacteria, food safety expert Tom Chestnut of NSF International says not reliably.
Washing of fruits and vegetables are very good means to get reduction of the bacteria that's on the outside, but it's very difficult to get a total elimination.
One reason is that the bacteria cling to the skin. Another is that it can get into the tomato through tiny pores in the skin. Chestnut says in packing houses, tomatoes are often submersed in chlorinated water. He explains if the rinse is too cold or the tomatoes too hot, the pores can open up and temperature can be a problem.
Because if you get too wide of a fluctuation in that, you can introduce contamination into the tomato itself.
Until officials figure out where the salmonella came from, consumers should eat only the cherry and grape varieties or tomatoes still on the vine. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Now, you've probably heard quite a few stories over the years about the growing number of Americans without health insurance. The latest number is 47 million. A new study came out this week that showed that there's another problem with insurance, and it's growing too, and that's underinsurance. These are people who have health insurance but really can't afford to get all the care they need. NPR's Julie Rovner took a closer look at the study and prepared this report.
Jolita Aikman of Cleveland thought her family was taken care of on the health insurance front. Her husband, who works for a national home improvement chain, has $275 taken out of his paycheck every 2 weeks to cover the premiums for their family of three. Then last year, her husband's neck gave out.
He had to have three discs removed and a steel plate put in, and he was out of work for 2 months.
And the Aikmans' medical bills, even with the insurance, began to mount.
Just the copays, the deductibles, and simply stuff that they did not cover are piling up so much that it's unbearable right now.
Aikman says she's not one to shirk her bills, but what the family owes is simply more than they can afford, particularly with such high insurance premiums.
I'm getting phone calls a couple times a week, and I tell them I'm just paying what I can. And I do. I just pay what I can, and I'm sorry, there's nothing else I can do about it, but what can you do? I'm already paying $550 a month.
Aikman is one of a growing legion of Americans with health insurance who are still considered underinsured. According to the new study by researchers from the Commonwealth Fund, the number of underinsured working-age adults has ballooned by 60% in just the past 4 years. Kathy Shane is the study's lead author.
What we have is a whole group of people that have insurance, and in fact, when they get sick, they are finding you can have insurance all year and still go bankrupt.
Researchers counted people as underinsured if they spent at least 10% of their income on medical expenses, or 5% if their income was below about $40,000 a year. They were also considered underinsured if they had health insurance with a very high deductible, more than 5% of their family's income. Using those definitions, the study found that more than 40% of the under 65 adult population was either underinsured or lacked health coverage altogether in 2007. And Shane says the biggest increase came in middle and upper income families.
And the underinsured rates in that group tripled.
And being underinsured has real consequences for people's health, Shane says.
They put off going for care when they're sick, prescriptions when they're sick. They don't follow up on recommended care at rates that look extraordinarily like the uninsured.
About the only silver lining, says Shane, is that as the problem reaches increasingly into the middle class, there may be more of an imperative for policymakers to finally address it. Julie Rovner, NPR News.
There are many people out there who say that high health costs could be cured, or at least reduced, through the computerization of medical records. Now, some larger doctor practices, group practices, have started doing this, but most smaller practices haven't. Some hospitals have computerized their medical records, but the problem there is many times the hospitals can't communicate with one another. The government over the past couple of years has been trying to deal with these problems, trying to encourage standardization of the computer systems, and to try to encourage doctor practices to computerize. Officials at Medicare, the program for the elderly and disabled, started a pilot project this week where they're offering physicians money to get started. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports that even with the money, it's going to take some convincing.
Earlier this spring, Medicare Administrator Kerry Weems went out on the road.
So what we're here to talk about are electronic health records.
He was talking to several dozen doctors, hospital officials, and insurance company representatives in Baltimore. His goal? Convince them to be part of a pilot project for computerization.
You know, we know electronic health records can save money, can improve health outcomes through better care, can avoid duplicative tests, avoid some invasive tests, and perhaps even reduce administrative costs.
Internet companies like Google and Microsoft are marketing individual health records where patients fill in their own information. But most health officials believe the big payoff is where doctors and hospitals directly computerize their charts. The benefit for patients is that doctors can see the full health record. Insurers can better monitor the care that doctors give, but doctors themselves don't benefit financially. So at that Baltimore meeting, Medicare Administrator Kerry Weems got some pushback from Ronald Sroka. He's an old-style family doctor who's been in the same office in suburban Crofton, Maryland for 30 years.
Being a primary care physician and a solo practitioner and having been with larger groups, it's my category that's going to be impacted the most. For one physician to have to share the costs alone.
Which is why the Department of Health and Human Services is pushing the pilot project. In 12 areas around the U.S., including Maryland, doctors will be able to apply to get up to $58,000 over the next 5 years for computerizing. Group practices can get $290,000. But that may not be enough. Sally Seiler is the administrator for a practice of 17 doctors, and by her estimate, $290,000 just won't do it. She's calculated it would cost several times that amount.
And there's more than just a hardware-software cost. There's huge costs in training. I might have to hire an IT person to handle all the additional infrastructure for these medical records.
And she's still got 40 years of paper medical records to store somewhere. Physician Ronald Sroka voiced several other concerns. Would his patients' records remain private? Would insurers use the information to tell him how to practice medicine? And one more.
A standard system for what everyone should use has not been established. It is very possible and has already happened that physicians expended large amounts of money on a program that turned out wasn't interactive with the people that they needed to interact with because they were with a different program.
That's something the Department of Health and Human Services has been working on for years. And Secretary Michael Levitt says that while standardization efforts are moving slower than he'd like, they are moving along. Dr. Sroka thought about it after leaving the meeting, and now he says he's leaning towards applying to be in the pilot project.
I think it's coming, whether I like it or not, and somehow or the other I'm going to have to afford it, regardless of whether I want to or not.
Medicare officials will collect data during the pilot project, seeing whether or why physicians drop out, and whether Medicare needs to do anything else to get more doctors to sign on. Administrator Carrie Williams expects some problems along the way. If establishing a national system of medical records were going to be easy, he says, it would have been done already. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
Research has shown that keeping aging brains active can improve health. One way to do that is through volunteering. NPR's Joseph Shapiro visited a school in Ohio that's put an innovative twist on volunteering.
Start from the beginning.
That's a good place to start.
Okay.
Here's the scene you can find in lots of schools all over the country. An older woman, she's a volunteer in the school, helps a 7-year-old boy read.
His walkie-talkie, the
antenna.
Antenna was damp.
Dangling.
Dangling.
But at this school in Cleveland, many of the volunteers aren't just elderly. They've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, like the woman reading with the boy on the small couch in the school hallway.
But Walter just
ignored him.
Ignored him.
That's a pretty hard word.
Barbara Kelsey is 84. Her red hair is covered with a silk scarf, folded like a bandana. She's sitting next to a young woman who picks her up at her assisted living facility and drives her to this school. When there's a break in the reading, I ask Kelsey about her volunteer work.
You're a mentor here?
No.
Yes.
I am.
Her name's Barbara Kelsey.
So tell me what you do when you come to the school.
I don't do anything really much except I'd sit and listen to them. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, tell them if they, you know, they don't know exactly how to do something, I help them figure it out.
Sometimes she remembers, but sometimes she doesn't.
I think you met Miss Kelsey.
Kathy Whitehouse is the principal and co-founder of this small inner-city charter school. It's called the Intergenerational School. And part of its philosophy is to bring in lots of volunteers of all ages. Kathy Whitehouse says last year, Barbara Kelsey volunteered more than anyone.
She was the volunteer who was given the Volunteer of the Year award for the most hours at the school last year and turned to her caregiver at the luncheon and said, "Why am I getting this?" And the young woman said to her, "Because you come here and read with the children." And she said, "I do."
Whitehouse says it doesn't matter because Barbara Kelsey is good at what she does.
When you see her sitting with a child and reading, she's able to interact with that child in the moment. She's able to read. I firmly believe that she enjoys the time that she spends here. And if she doesn't remember it 5 minutes later, it doesn't matter. It's just been great to have her.
A person with dementia may no longer be able to read and comprehend an adult book, but Whitehouse realized they can still read a kid's book. Kathy Whitehouse started this school 8 years ago with her husband, Peter. He's a geriatric neurologist.
I think some people who, when they get the label Alzheimer's disease, feel shame, and they themselves withdraw themselves from society.
So Dr. Whitehouse tells his patients with cognitive disabilities to stay socially active, to keep going to the Cleveland Orchestra if they like music, or to volunteer at a school like this one.
I found out that Mrs. Hardesty was dating 3 people.
The volunteers in this room come once a week from a nearby retirement community. Many have mild, but some have advanced dementia. 2 volunteers live on a locked dementia unit. The assignment today is for the students, who are teens and preteens, to ask the older volunteers about lessons and wisdom they can pass on from their life experiences.
But she finally picked her husband because she said they fell in love with each other. And when they tied the knot, he pulled over to the side of the road and said, "I think it's time we just get married." And then she said, "Okay."
For older people with no dementia, research suggests that regular volunteer work increases physical strength and wards off depression and isolation. Volunteers report more cognitive activity. Now Peter Whitehouse is trying to prove that volunteering has health benefits for people with Alzheimer's and dementia, too.
We presume, although we're doing the research to try to demonstrate it, that engagement is not only as good, but perhaps better and more necessary for older people who have what I call aging-associated cognitive challenges.
He's working with graduate student Daniel George. They've written a book called The Myth of Alzheimer's.
We are looking at whether volunteering at the intergenerational school improves quality of life. And to do that, we're looking at five variables: cognitive functioning, stress, depression, sense of purpose, and sense of usefulness.
They tested these volunteers at the start of the school year and then at the end. The study is ongoing and too small, just 20 volunteers, to settle anything. But they say they're able to see change in their volunteers, like Marilee Hardesty. She's 91. Back in her assisted living unit, Hardesty doesn't use the words Alzheimer's or dementia. She talks instead about the thing she calls her problem, and how when it developed last fall, it hit her hard.
And I thought I might as well quit. I was really down in the dumps about the whole thing. There was a time that I hated to go down to dinner because I just couldn't talk to people. It was awful.
Two things lifted her from that despair: a support group of other people dealing with memory loss, and her volunteer work at the Cleveland School.
And the kids, you know, we always find a lot of things to laugh about. Just having kids around has always been very good for me, so it was a good thing.
Not everyone is so sure that the experiment at the intergenerational school can be applied more broadly. Columbia University geriatrician Linda Freed has started a national school volunteer program and researched its health benefits. She thinks it may be impractical to let people with dementia who need help themselves volunteer in schools.
For cognitively impaired older adults, it can feel chaotic because little kids are busy. It can get confusing if you have memory problems and problem-solving problems. So you'd have to learn how to design the environment and have the resources to do that.
The intergenerational school is set up specifically to handle volunteers of all ages and abilities. Mary Kelsey appreciates that. She's the daughter of Barbara Kelsey, the woman who was the volunteer of the year but didn't remember all her volunteer work.
For my mother, helping other people in some way has always been part of how she defines herself.
Before Barbara Kelsey was diagnosed with Alzheimer's 6 years ago, she taught adults how to read. She was a library volunteer who took books to nursing homes and prisons.
One of the great losses of aging in our culture is that people sort of fall out of the place that they had for themselves, the place that has meaning.
So Mary Kelsey tried to restore her mother to a place of meaning. She found the school, and she added something else her mother always liked: music. The next day, at Barbara Kelsey's assisted living facility, the piano teacher shows up.
Are you giving me a lesson? Is that what we're doing?
Oh, my gosh. I haven't had a lesson for a long time. I've forgotten what to do. Oh, my gosh.
She gets music lessons 5 days a week. The teacher, Louis Calataris, takes out the sheet music.
Now, let's start with the Ode to Joy. Let's try that once.
I don't even know that very well.
I'll give you the E.
Okay.
That's the E.
The teacher plays the first note, and then Barbara Kelsey plays, tentatively at first, and then with more assurance. Some people see Barbara Kelsey as a woman with Alzheimer's.
Do you want me to go on?
But her daughter says if you tell her mother she's got an illness, Barbara Kelsey simply says, "I'm fine." Her daughter says it's something her mother can say because she's still active in the world.
I'm going to play the accompaniment.
Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
That's it for this week's podcast. You can hear more health stories by tuning into your local NPR station. There's a list of them at npr.org. While you're there, you can find more health and science stories by clicking on the link over on the left side of the page. Thanks for listening. I'm Joe Neal, NPR News.